From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we look ahead at the new Republican-led Congress with political analyst George Will. He's a syndicated columnist and a panelist on ABC TV's This Week with David Brinkley. The U.S. is withdrawing from enforcement of the arms embargo against the Bosnian government. We'll discuss the political and military impact of that decision with journalist Misha Glenny. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Fables of Abundance, a new cultural history of advertising. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. As expected, the Federal Reserve has raised interest rates for the sixth time this year in an effort to slow growth and keep inflation at bay. After a closed-door meeting in Washington, the central bank indicated it is pushing up two key rates. The benchmark rate, which banks charge each other on overnight loans, will increase from 4.75 points to 5.5 points. The Fed is also raising its discount rate by 0.75 point. The higher rates are expected to show up immediately in the rates charged to millions of Americans on everything from home equity loans to credit cards. The Children's Defense Fund says child poverty is costing the U.S. economy billions of dollars a year in lost productivity. The group's president is calling on the new Republican Congress to recognize the problem and do something about it. NPR's Carol Ann Clark Kelly reports.
The president of the Children's Defense Fund is calling for new government programs to create jobs and make daycare more affordable. Marion Wright Edelman acknowledges the new political climate, but says she's hopeful that once the election excitement dies down, her group will be able to work with the new Republican leadership.
I cannot believe for a moment that Republicans any more than Democrats want to see parents go without jobs, and so I assume that when we sit down with them with the facts, show them how the failure to invest in children earlier is costing America through the nose. I am convinced that they will conclude that good sense and fairness requires that they continue to invest in children on the front end.
Edelman says her group intends to write its own contract, this one for American kids. I'm Carol Ann Clark Kelly in Washington.
The Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum has ended in Indonesia with a new agreement to eliminate trade barriers in the region by the year 2020. President Clinton hailed the new accord in a news conference in Jakarta. On domestic matters, the president said he thinks it will be possible to cooperate with the new Republican Congress on a number of issues. Meanwhile, in Washington, members of the Clinton administration have begun meeting with leaders of that new Congress. UPI's Carol Van Dam reports.
White House Chief of Staff Leon Panetta is paying a courtesy call to Senate Republican leader Robert Dole and Republican Congressman Newt Gingrich this afternoon. The head of the House Republican Transition Team, Jim Nussle of Iowa, says transition talks with key Democrats have gone smoothly so far.
We're going to do it together, and we have a specific plan of outreach to them. We're working together closely with the Speaker's office, with Mr. Gephardt's office. It's been nothing but cooperative.
Nussle held the first in what he says will be a series of daily briefings on the transition. Carol Van Dam, Capitol Hill.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 6 points at 3823.67. Trading is heavy. 329 million shares have changed hands. This is NPR News in Washington. The National Transportation Safety Board is recommending that commuter airlines be governed by the same safety rules which apply to major carriers. It's proposing rule changes to reduce the amount of time commuter pilots spend in the air, tighten their training standards, and increase safety inspections. NTSB Chairman Jim Hall says the commuter airlines are safe, but the changes would make them even safer. A controversial New York City professor must return to court in a continuing legal battle over free speech and university discipline. From member station WNYC, Dick Hinchcliffe reports.
City College of New York professor Leonard Jeffries was temporarily removed as chairman of the Black Studies Department after a 1991 off-campus speech. Jeffries accused Jews of financing the slave trade and conspiring with the mafia to denigrate African Americans in Hollywood movies. City College classified the remarks as hate speech and removed Jeffries as chairman. When Jeffries filed suit, a federal judge ruled his First Amendment rights were violated and ordered the college to reinstate him as chairman and pay $360,000 in damages. An appeals court upheld the decision but ordered a new trial on damages. On Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court ordered the circuit court to review the case in light of a recent Supreme Court decision giving public employers more leeway to fire workers for expressing opinions that are likely to disrupt the workplace. For National Public Radio, I'm Dick Hinchliff in New York.
It appears as if Democrat Paris Glendening will be Maryland's next governor. Election officials have finished counting absentee ballots in that race, and final results give Glendening a lead of more than 3,200 votes over Republican Ellen Sauerbrey. A study released today in Britain finds preliminary evidence that smoking is more likely to cause lung cancer in women than in men. British and Norwegian researchers say women run twice the risk of developing lung cancer from cigarettes. I'm Ann Bozell, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new Republican leaders of the House are preparing for what they describe as a new order, a transformation of the governing process. My guest, George Will, is a conservative political analyst who now has the opportunity, for the first time in his career, to comment on a Republican Congress. Will is a regular panelist on ABC's Sunday morning program This Week with David Brinkley. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning syndicated newspaper columnist and a columnist for Newsweek. His columns from the past 4 years are collected in his new book, The Leveling Wind. I asked Will how he interpreted the Republican victory in the House and Senate. Is it a vote for change that favored the Republicans this time around? Or is this a sign of a more dramatic move toward the right?
I think it's a particularly dramatic step in a 28-year march to the right so far. I think this movement to the right began with the 1966 elections, in which the Republicans gained, I think, 47 net seats in the House in reaction to the perceived disappointments and excesses of the Great Society. And the country's been steadily moving rightward ever since. The country today is much more conservative than when Reagan was elected, markedly more conservative even than 2 years ago when Clinton was elected. And I'm defining conservatism in a rough but useful index of hostility to government in general and the central government in particular.
What do you think, too, about the idea that people don't want government and don't want government to pay for programs, except for the programs that benefit me?
Well, that's the old argument, that the American people are ideologically conservative but operationally liberal. I do think we began to see in the last election a readiness on the part of people to say, of course I benefit from my representative in Washington looting and pillaging and from the public trough on my behalf, but there are 434 other congressmen doing that. And maybe we're all not net winners. Maybe we're net losers collectively as a result of this. There was one person in the 5th District of Washington State, the Foley District. It was quoted approximately as follows in the Washington Post. He said, yes, Foley's been a great man, and he's done wonderful things for this district. But anyone who can't, if someone by being so senior can bring so many millions of dollars back from Washington, Washington must be a corrupt place. So there's a deep ambivalence now about this interest group liberalism that we've been practicing for 30 or 40 years.
I want to ask you a question I've been asking other guests about the election, and that is, what do you think of the difference in the political style and the political priorities between Dole and Gingrich?
Well, it's going to be marvelous theater because Senator Dole is a senator. He's partakes of the somewhat more relaxed, somewhat more collegial atmosphere of the upper chamber. Senator Dole is a legislator, that is, a man who wants to make deals. He wants to move the machinery forward. He said on ABC on election night, when asked what he was going to say when he placed his post-election phone call to the president, Mr. Dole said, I'm going to tell him we Republicans don't want to be locked out of the process anymore. Now, that's a fairly modest complaint. Mr. Gingrich and the radicalized House Republicans want much more than to be at the table, to use another favorite phrase of Mr. Dole, much more than to keep the machinery ticking over and be part of the tick-tock of it all. These people have believed the government has been going in the wrong direction for a very long time, and they want to stop it in its tracks.
So what kind of theater do you think we'll be seeing?
Well, you're going to see tension between the more populist, more aggressive, less experienced House of Representatives and the more sedate upper chamber. The two bodies are now taking on somewhat the character that the founders envisioned, that the House would be a measure of the turbulence of opinion in the country, and the Senate would be a somewhat more stable body. Washington is said to have said, it's a little hard to track this down, that the Senate is the saucer into which we pour our coffee that it may cool. And a lot of stuff's going to get poured from the House into the Senate where it may cool, not to say congeal.
George Will is my guest, and he has a new collection of his pieces called The Leveling Wind. I'd like your assessment of how powerful the Christian right now is within the Republican Party.
It's a very strong, electorally effective minority. All three of those characteristics obtain, and it's the third that sometimes gets lost sight of. It is a minority. The Christian right is fairly strong, very strong in the South, somewhat strong in other states, but as the idea that it is the dominant force, a controlling force in the National Party, is just not true.
I guess as a political commentator, I'm curious whether you see yourself as being in alliance or in support of the Christian groups.
No, certainly not. I'm not a churchgoer. I'm just a walking around, fairly conservative American writer.
So is there something that troubles you about their agenda or their approach to promoting their agenda, or is it just a personal thing that you're not a churchgoer yourself, therefore you're not close to them?
I'm not close to them, and I'm not bothered by them particularly. It seems to me that this is a continental nation of 260, 70 million people. You're bound to have these interesting ginger groups and factions. And I think they give our politics weight, and they give it the dignity of ideas and convictions, and prevent it from becoming merely a maelstrom of economic interests.
How closely is Newt Gingrich connected politically with the religious right?
Well, I think very closely, because they have been very important in energizing particular constituencies in particular districts.
So what do you think that means in terms of power sharing in the next few years?
Nothing much. The Tom Kaine, the former governor of New Jersey, a moderate Republican by anyone's understanding, was for a while somewhat alarmed by the religious right. And then he went and met with leaders of the religious right and came away saying, you know, these are just sort of normal, fairly conservative Americans, but with a basically mainstream agenda. They want welfare reform, they want smaller government, they want less intrusive government, they like balanced budgets and all the rest. The idea that abortion characterizes the religious right. It may characterize some of their strongest feelings, but it will not characterize the effect they have on our politics, because remember, when the Republicans controlled the Senate for 6 years in the 1980s, that Senate did not even bring to a vote a constitutional amendment on abortion. There wasn't, I believe, a vote on a voluntary, so-called voluntary prayer in school amendment. It is to me, astonishing that people run for governor or even for alderman in this country taking positions on abortion when everyone knows that the Supreme Court is not going to repeal Roe v. Wade. Furthermore, should Roe v. Wade be overthrown, which it will not be, there probably isn't a state in the Union that would seriously impede first trimester abortions, which are 95% of abortions. This issue is settled. The culture has moved. And a consensus has emerged, a majority consensus, granted with a vocal and unreconciled minority in the country, a consensus has emerged in favor of liberal abortion policies. People can relax.
Let me ask you about something that confuses me. I think that you feel that government should play a fairly minimal role in the lives of individuals in America. And yet, you know, the Christian groups seem to have chosen as their primary issues that most people would consider to be pretty personal: sexual orientation, abortion, which you've addressed, you know, the whole family agenda. And so you could surely argue that this part of the right in America is really making more of an argument that government should be involved in personal lives.
Well, there's no question that some factions of the conservative movement are more libertarian than others. On the other hand, we have to be careful when we talk about, say, some conservatives having anxieties about homosexual lifestyle and all the rest. The question there is not always, in fact, is rarely, that the religious right or conservatives want punitive legislation. Generally, what they are responding to are what they consider provocations, and they're responding in defensive ways. For example, when some of the people of Queens, the borough of Queens in New York City, rose up, they did not rise up in hostility, sort of unprovoked hostility to homosexuals. They rose up against a school board that they felt was mandating a particular propaganda in their classrooms. You remember the issue about the curriculum that had books, Heather Has Two Mommies and all the rest.
Yeah, it was called the Rainbow Curriculum.
That's right. And they felt that they were being provoked and were acting defensively. So it doesn't seem to me that it's fair or accurate to suggest that the religious right or anyone else on the right is marauding around looking for ways to be aggressive against other people. They want left alone.
My guest is syndicated columnist George Will. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with George Will. His new book is a collection of columns called The Leveling Wind. A word that is often used in describing Newt Gingrich is bomb thrower. I don't know if you'd agree with that or not, but I'm wondering, as a student of the American political process, what you think of his approach to legislating, if you think that it's good to have somebody who's more on an extreme end like that within the political process, or if you think he doesn't have sufficient respect for the give and take of the political process.
Well, let's wait and see. First of all, he has had no chance to legislate because he has been living in a house run with increasing authoritarian sternness by the Democrats over the last decade. As recently as, say, 1978-79, about 70% of the measures that came to the floor of the House came under what are called open rules. That is, they could be amended by the minority. The minority could at least propose amendments. In the final years of the Foley-Gephardt dictatorship, and I don't use that casually, most legislation came to the floor under closed rules. The Democrats have run the House in an authoritarian manner, so we don't know what the Republicans will do as legislators. But what we do know is they won't abuse power any more than the Democrats have done. Indeed, one of the pledges the Republicans have made is that they will not turn around and inflict on the Democrats the kind of authoritarian regime that the Democrats imposed on the Republicans in the House. When you say Mr. Gingrich is an extremist, I think you and I may differ as to where the American center is now. Mr. Gingrich is a lot closer to the American center than, say, Mr. Gephardt is.
How much follow-through do you expect on the contract with America?
Lots. I think the Republicans said, pin it on your refrigerator, and if we don't follow through, throw us out.
Crime figures into the contract with America. The emphasis is on cutting social spending from this summer's crime bill and to build more prisons and to add more law enforcement. I don't believe the contract says anything about addressing the causes of crime, does it?
Well, it depends on what you think the causes of crime are. The basic causes of crime are young men age 14 to 21 or 22. You can cast your description of the cause of crime in a variety of ways. If you assume that, say, poverty is the cause of crime, then you can say the Republicans are not serious about fighting the causes of crime. But since most poor people are not criminals, it's not clear in what sense poverty is the cause of crime. So what I think Republicans and conservatives generally are saying is, we don't know quite what causes crime. We certainly don't know how to engineer a society in a way that will produce non-criminal behavior at all times and all places. Therefore, what we can do in the way of fighting crime is to catch people, convict them in a speedy way, and incarcerate them in a serious way.
There was an article in the Sunday Times about growth in crime and a lot about the demography. Apparently, demographers are predicting a big crime rave.
Absolutely.
Shortly after the turn of the century, because there'll be so many young teenagers.
You can see the bulge of young men.
So this is a quote from Alan Fox, the dean of the College of Criminal Justice at Northeastern University. He said, to prevent a bloodbath in the year 2005, when we will have a flood of 15-year-olds, we have to do something today with 5-year-olds. But when push comes to shove, prevention programs often fall by the wayside in favor of increased incarceration. I think one of the things he might be referring to there is the contracts proposal that single mothers who are, I think it's just basically single teenage mothers, won't get any form of welfare benefits. And if there's a problem, their children will be sent to orphanages. I know Newt Gingrich has proposed that.
Well, the orphanages are not in the Republican contract, but various Republicans have talked about this, but so have people who are independents and extremely distinguished academics and scholars, such as James Q. Wilson, has talked about this possibility. Perhaps Professor Fox at Northeastern knows what social programs can be designed that will work to prevent crime. If so, he ought to get on the Metro Liner and get down here and tell people, because down here in Washington, people are a lot less confident than Professor Fox seems to be about our knowledge of how to prevent crime. It is the case that there is now underway a fundamental questioning of the welfare state, and it is related to the question of illegitimacy. In 1963 and 4, when young Pat Moynihan, then of the Kennedy and Johnson labor departments, published his report on the crisis of the black family, at a time when 26% of all black children were born to single women, Pat wrote an article in which he said approximately the following. He said, the lesson of history is clear. From the wild Irish slums of the 19th century to South Central Los Angeles today, when you have a large cohort of essentially unparented adolescent males, you have chaos. Today we have chaos in parts of our cities where life is a slow-motion riot, precisely because in many central cities, 80% of the children born are born to unwed mothers. Now that is going to be a crisis wherever it happens. And the argument is that the welfare state's growth has not only coincided with, but may be causally related to, this explosion of social pathology since the late 1960s and early 70s, the worst of which is illegitimacy. So, the argument goes, we have to now consider whether or not the government is actually doing harm in the name of doing good, whether or not it is a kindness that kills. And the argument, put most crudely, is when you subsidize something, be it wheat or illegitimacy, you get more of it, and that we are, with generosity toward unwed mothers, we are subsidizing illegitimacy and getting more of it, and in the train of that development, more crime.
You know, conservatives would say that it's our programs that have been responsible in part for the growing level of crime, and then liberals would argue, but since 1980, there's been cutbacks in those programs and crime's been going up, so you can't exactly blame those programs for what's been happening because the crime's been on the rise since the Reagan years. So give me your argument.
But throughout the 1980s, the government subventions for unmarried mothers have been much more generous throughout the 1980s than they were under, say, President Kennedy in the 1960s.
As a conservative, do you feel that you play a slightly different role in your country's politics when you're criticizing Democrats as opposed to when you're criticizing Republicans or fellow conservatives?
No, I don't think so. In fact, one of the reasons I wrote the book on term limits was because I've come to believe strongly that we have a political class. And by class, I mean a group of Republicans and Democrats alike, who are more united by interests and patterns of behavior than they are divided by ideas. Now, that may be changing a bit as we become more ideological, but basically, journalism is not romance. Journalism is writing about, in a fairly cold-eyed way, about fallible human beings in positions of constant temptation, which power is. So it's not as though Republicans win a majority in Congress and a bright new dawn breaks.
Did you ever want to go into politics yourself?
No, not really.
You started off, though, working in a legislator's office, didn't you?
I did. I worked on Capitol Hill for 3 years, had a wonderful time, learned a lot. But in the first place, writing for me is a metabolic necessity. I'd explode if I didn't do it. So I want to continue doing that. Second, I'm quite clear in my own mind that the great pleasures of life are in private life, children, families, all that stuff.
Would you feel that politics interferes too much with that private side of life?
Oh, absolutely. The dirty little secret, and indeed it's less and less of a secret, is that electoral politics swallows the life and requires a distortion of life in a way that is extremely painful and costly to families.
That's an interesting point, and I wonder if you think that that is affecting those who do. I mean, weeding out some people from ever entering the political process they fear that.
Absolutely.
And, uh-huh.
That combined, not just all I've spoken about so far, is the devouring demands on time. There also is the relentless and now limitless assault on privacy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you take those two, and obviously a great many good men and women say, what's the point? Indeed, it has been said that anyone who will do what it is necessary to do to become president is thereby disqualified from being president. That's exactly the kind of person you don't want out there, someone driven, obsessed, monomaniacal, and willing to sacrifice the interests of those nearest and dearest to him.
This is a pretty major problem, wouldn't you say?
Yes, I should say so.
So how does a country go about fixing something like that?
Well, they all rush out and buy Will's earlier book on term limits. and they become convinced that one way you do that is by ending careerism in politics. You make politics an episode in a mature, normal life.
I've got one last question for you. How did you survive this fall without the World Series?
Alarmingly well. If I were the owners, I would take cognizance of just how many people there are like me, who found that baseball is a habit. It's not like football. Football's a spectacle. Baseball's a daily habit. And the thing about habits is you can break them. And a lot of us have broken our baseball habits. And whether or not we'll ever get them back is a contingent question.
It sounds like a warning.
It's a shot across their bow, yes.
George Will, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was fun.
George Will has a new book that collects his columns from the past 4 years. It's called The Leveling Wind. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The U.S. is withdrawing from enforcing the arms embargo against the government of Bosnia. Coming up, we talk with journalist Misha Glenny about that decision and how it could affect the war in Bosnia and the NATO alliance. Misha Glenny is a British journalist who has been covering the war since it began. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews a new book that takes a look at how advertising has shaped American consumerism and materialism. It's called Fables of Abundance. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
Says he doesn't think the Fed is finished yet.
I do not think that they will go again this year, but I do think they will gauge the tenor of business activity and will move again, probably a full percentage point, maybe in two stages during the first quarter of next year.
Consumers should feel the effects of today's rate hikes, with increases in consumer loans on everything from home equity loans to credit cards. President Clinton says he has high hopes for the new Pacific Asia Free Trade Agreement announced today in Jakarta. The large industrial nations in the region have agreed to lower trade barriers by the year 2010, with other countries following suit 10 years later.
Under this agreement, individual APEC nations will have to tear down trade barriers to reap trade benefits. And no country will get more in benefits than it gives. No free riders. Today's agreement will lower barriers even further than the historic GATT World Trade Agreement.
The president said the agreement is good news for the United States because it will increase markets for American-produced goods. It's been almost a week since the elections, and several races are still undecided, including the governor's race in Alaska. But there is a winner in the Maryland governor's race, as NPR's Laura Kanoy reports.
With all the ballots counted, elections officials say Paris Glendening won the governor's race by about 3,400 votes. But GOP candidate Ellen Sauerbrey continues to challenge the results. She charges some voters who used absentee ballots didn't follow the right procedures, and she's assembled a volunteer fraud squad that's checking for possible violations. Sauerbrey may also challenge the election's results in court when the state certifies the count within the next week. The governor's race was tight all along, despite the fact that Democrats outnumber Republicans 2-1 in Maryland. Sauerbrey centered her campaign on a 24% income tax cut. Glendening promised to improve the state's public schools and strengthen the police force. This is Laura Kanoy reporting.
The National Transportation Safety Board is recommending that commuter airlines be regulated under the same strict rules that now cover major carriers. Board Chairman Jim Hall says the regional carriers are safe but could be even safer. The changes would reduce the amount of time commuter pilots can spend in the air, tighten training standards, and increase the number of safety inspections. On Wall Street, stock prices closed mixed today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 3 1/3 points to close at 3826.36. Trading was heavy, 336 million shares. This is NPR News. Tropical Storm Gordon is churning into the Gulf of Mexico. The storm is about 35 miles northwest of Key West, Florida, moving slowly to the northwest. Its winds are clocked at 50 miles per hour, and it continues to dump rain on southern and central Florida. The entire Sunshine State is under a tornado watch at this hour. Haiti has declared a state of emergency in the wake of Tropical Storm Gordon. Prime Minister Marc Michel has pledged $3 million to help clean up after the storm, which has killed at least 100 Haitians. Thousands were left homeless by yesterday's heavy rains and flooding. China will ban ultrasound testing on pregnant women if the tests are only being used to determine the baby's gender. Chinese often abort females because they'd rather give birth to a son. Matt Forney reports from Beijing.
The Chinese say sons married, daughters are married off. Boys are traditionally earmarked for inheritance, farm labor, and carrying on the family name. For poor peasants, that means the benefits of raising a girl go to her future husband's family. Because of the country's strict one-child policy to ease overpopulation, parents of girls don't get another shot at a boy. So those who can afford it have sought help from ultrasound machines and aborted female embryos. That's led to a serious sex imbalance. 114 Chinese boys are born for every 100 girls, much higher than the international average of 105 to 100. When the ban goes into effect next year, ultrasound testing will still be allowed, but only to check the fetus's health. For National Public Radio, I'm Matt Forney in Beijing.
Roman Catholic bishops from throughout the United States are meeting today to consider a proposed pastoral message on violence. It would urge Catholics to work for peace by opposing abortion, euthanasia, and the death penalty. It also calls for support of gun control, racial harmony, and global disarmament. I'm Ann Bozell, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Americans have been so busy keeping up with the elections that many of us have lost track of what's happening in Bosnia. Last week, the Clinton administration announced it will no longer participate in NATO's enforcement of the arms embargo against the Muslim-led Bosnian government. Congress had already voted to cut off all funds for enforcing the ban as of today if the Serbs had not agreed to a peace accord. America's withdrawal can affect the course of the war and the future of NATO. My guest, Misha Glennie, is a British journalist who has been covering the war in the Balkans since it began. He's a former BBC correspondent and author of the book The Fall of Yugoslavia. I asked Glennie about the significance of America's action.
It's very important symbolically, this cessation of the monitoring of the embargo, but it does not mean a great deal in practical terms. It simply means that those American ships, if they find arms bound apparently for Bosnia, except, as they point out, for heavy weaponry, missile systems and so on, they will just turn a blind eye and let it go. But then that ship carrying those weapons will soon run into a British or a French vessel carrying out the same job, and the British and the French vessel will prevent the ship from unloading its cargo. So nothing will happen practically. I don't think that the Bosnian Muslims will be getting any more weapons than they are now, although, of course, they have been getting a lot of weapons overland for quite a long time. They've been supplied by the Iranian government. They have been supplied through Slovenia with the help of Croatia from some countries, weapons from some countries in Eastern Europe, from some countries in Central Europe. There have even been accusations, which have not been substantiated, that the Americans have actually been encouraging and turning a blind eye to this for a long time. But at the moment, there is no proof that that is the case.
Why has the United States pulled out of military enforcement of the blockade?
Well, I think President Clinton has made it fairly clear that he has pulled out because of congressional pressure. There has obviously been considerable congressional pressure, and indeed from within his own administration, to lift the arms embargo on the Bosnian government. Now, if you see what President Clinton has said about lifting of the arms embargo over the past, say, 6 to 9 months, it becomes fairly clear that the president himself has no desire whatsoever to lift the embargo. Although he sticks with the rhetoric of lifting the embargo, when it actually comes to saying, right, we're going to do it, there's always a sort of stalling clause in that statement. And so he puts it back and back. The reason for this is very clear, and he does point this out fairly obviously, is that if he were to lift the arms embargo unilaterally, not only would he be breaking the consensus politics of NATO, thus creating considerable tension between the United States and its allies in Europe, but he would be busting wide open a United Nations Security Council resolution. Now, that means very serious problems with the Russians over a whole range of issues. If you bust the Bosnian arms embargo resolution, then the Russians will come back to you and say, okay, no ball with Iraq, no, we're not going to play ball with Haiti. In fact, we're going to, if you're going to flout the UN Security Council, then we too will ensure that there will be no cooperation in the one body which can coordinate to a degree international policy.
You think there are countries that are afraid that the United States will be starting a bad precedent by unilaterally breaking an agreement?
Oh, I think that it would have tremendous consequences for international relations in the post-Cold War period. And for that reason, I think that President Clinton is trying to avoid everything to do it, including making concessions like the cessation of monitoring the embargo so that he can go back to Congress and say, well, you know, it really is a bit tough for us to lift the arms embargo unilaterally, but I have at least ensured that we're no longer monitoring it, and so we're sort of cleaning our hands to an extent from the embargo. But, you know, if for any reason he were to succumb to that congressional pressure and lift the arms embargo unilaterally, then we would be entering into an extremely different world diplomatically, politically, and possibly even militarily.
What has NATO reaction been to the American plan to stop enforcing the arms embargo?
Well, the European allies of the United States in Europe reacted to the announcement with extreme concern. I think part of the reason they reacted so nervously and expressing such worry about this was because they found out about it through a story leaked to the New York Times, i.e. they had not been briefed on it, on what is for them an extremely important issue by the United States government. So they felt that insulted. But behind it, the concern is based upon the fact that NATO isn't really sure what it's meant to be doing in the post-Cold War world. Before 1989, before the Soviet Union and Eastern and the communist regimes in Eastern Europe's collapse, it was perfectly obvious what NATO was there for. It was to ensure security for the Western alliance. But now there are real divisions between, not just between the European members of NATO and the United States, but within the European members of NATO as well, as to what NATO should be doing, what its function should be doing. Should it be working out of area, that is, going into places like Bosnia and sorting things out with its superior military equipment? Should it be restricted to its original role of just defending NATO countries? Should it be expanding into Eastern Europe and taking on extra duties, securing the borders of other countries? What should it be doing? And instead of actually coming up with a coherent strategy for NATO, we are beginning to see divisions between the members of NATO as we have never seen before. And the Europeans panicked at the news that the Americans were stopping participating in this, because they felt that it was the first step on the road to a collapse of NATO. Now, this is probably exaggerated. I'm sure it's exaggerated, but it was very striking. I was monitoring all the European press when the announcement was made. It was very striking to see how there was a unanimous response in Paris, London, and Bonn to the American move, saying that this was unacceptable, and it concerned them greatly that the whole alliance was now being questioned. That reaction collapsed, sort of became milder after 2 days or so, once the Europeans had swallowed it. But it does raise a very serious question about NATO.
Journalist Misha Glenny is my guest. He's been covering the war in the Balkans since it began. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about America's withdrawal from the enforcement of the arms embargo against the Bosnian government. My guest is journalist Misha Glenny. This month, the General Assembly at the UN adopted a resolution urging the Security Council to exempt the Muslim-led Bosnian government from the arms embargo. And that passed 97-0. There are 61 abstentions. What weight does this carry? What's the significance of that vote?
None whatsoever in practical terms. A General Assembly resolution is not binding. It's only the Security Council that can lift that embargo. And it clearly expresses that around the world there are a lot of countries, particularly in the Islamic world, but also friends of the United States in various places, who feel that they cannot tolerate this embargo for moral reasons. However, those 61 exemptions included a lot of Europeans, and although it's quite understandable why the Islamic countries and indeed the United States find the embargo so difficult to accept on moral grounds, this is a war that is going on in Europe. European countries on the whole have troops stationed there, and should the war get out of hand, i.e. expand from Bosnia back into Croatia, between Serbia and Croatia, and then possibly down into the south of the Balkans, it is Europe which has to pick up the tab, and that would be a tab, a bill which would be rising exponentially, a massive increase, an escalation of the war from Bosnia-Herzegovina into other parts of the Balkans means that the north and the south of Europe are disconnected territorially by land, so I think that Europe considers anything which endangers the stability of the broader area of southeastern Europe simply unacceptable, particularly since the Europeans, the British, the French, the Spanish, the Dutch have troops in the middle of all this who are likely to be victims in the end, in the event of an escalation.
I may be wrong here, but it's my impression that a lot of Americans are losing interest in Bosnia and are losing track of what's happening there. On the other hand, you've been just immersed in this right from the start, and I wonder if you feel interest slipping away. Not yours, but other people's.
Well,
other people's,
you know,
as far away as here.
On occasions, I mean, you know, even my interest slips because you just, it becomes so despairing. But I mean, you know, not just in the United States, but in other parts of Europe as well. On those occasions when I travel to my native London, which I do about once every 6 months, I'm absolutely staggered by the lack of interest, indeed the ignorance about what's going on in the Balkans. For really quite... It's quite shattering when I see that there is not a great deal of interest, and the same is true here. This is partly because of overkill in the media, and partly, you know, the sort of boredom syndrome, which always happens when wars and conflicts are sort of mesmerically difficult to understand, and all you see on television is repeated. You know, scenes of violence and dead bodies and so on. So that's a normal state of affairs. I always try and explain to people that it's important that we keep interested in this topic and in this war, partly because the way that this war has been fought is unimaginable. I can't think of any war in the post-Second World War period where so much heavy artillery has been used against civilians to such a degree as it has here. So from a humanitarian point of view, we ought to be interested in it. But in a political view, well, let me tell you a little story. When I was recently in Skopje, in what is known officially as the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, whose security is still under a great deal of threat. It's a state which has no defence, which historically the four countries surrounding it have territorial claims over it, and are at the moment involved in various types of diplomatic and political intimidation against this country. And all the same, these people are trying to sort of encourage investment in the country and and try and get people in Europe and the United States interested in Macedonia, partly in order to ensure that a war won't break out there. And they produced a little sort of tourist-come-business investment leaflet, which was entitled brightly on the front, "Interested in Macedonia?" And this was a sort of huge poster in the tourist office I went to, and somebody had scrawled underneath, "You will be if you don't watch out." and that is what this war is about. This war can shatter southeastern Europe, can shatter the security of southern Europe, and have tremendous implications for the entire post-Cold War order, because Europe is one of the three great economic centres of the world, and a destabilisation of Europe is in nobody's interest.
Do the pressures ever get to you of being so closely covering the war for so long?
Well, I do get tired of it. I mean, the thing that's bothering me at the moment is I get slagged off by everyone, and I really shouldn't be worried about it. But
what do you mean slagged off?
Slagged off, sorry, that's a quaint old British phrase. That everybody attacks me. The Croats attack me because they say I'm a Chetnik, i.e. a sort of Serb militia. The Serbs say that, the Bosnian Serbs say that, I'm too sympathetic to the Muslims. The Muslims say I'm a traitor because I oppose the lifting of the arms embargo. The Bulgarians recently, a newspaper in Bulgaria wrote an article saying that I was working for the Greek intelligence service at the same time as I was being denounced on Greek radio for a piece I did for the New York Times, which they had translated, and claiming that I was abusing Greek hospitality by living in their country and writing untruths and so on against their country. And this happens wherever I go. Everyone hates me. This happens to, not just to me, but to other people as well. But after a while, you begin to find it really hard to take with the war, with the sort of emotional stress that goes with it, and just the travelling. I travel the whole time, and I spend my whole time thinking about this thing. You know, and I work 7 days a week. I had a holiday for about 5 or 6 days this summer. It's all my own fault. I mean, I could take off more time if I want to, but I'm just kind of obsessed by it. And so in that sense, you know, I've had it. And I think sometime soon I'm going to have to distance myself from it physically, or I'm just going to go around the bend, basically.
Well, I hope you take care of yourself, and I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Misha Glenny is the author of The Fall of Yugoslavia. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, what do you have on the Republicans as they prepare to take control of Congress?
Hi, Terry. A discussion tonight of the Republicans' contract with America. That's the party's pre-election promise to the voters. There's now dissension within the party about how to pay for those promises. Also, I'll talk with Senator Paul Simon, a Democrat from Illinois. He's decided not to run for re-election in 1996. Margo Adler reports on the growing use of children as soldiers around the world. The National Transportation Safety Board has some recommendations about the country's regional airlines and some memories of sound, this time from listeners.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Jackson Lears is one of this country's foremost cultural historians. In his 1981 book, No Place of Grace, he examined how many Americans around the turn of the century recoiled from modern life and instead sought solace in a cult religion's strenuous exercise and daydreams of the Middle Ages. In his latest book, Fables of Abundance, Lears traces the evolution of American consumer culture through advertising. Critic Maureen Corrigan says Fables of Abundance is so jam-packed with ideas and images, it made her head spin.
Fables of Abundance is a cultural history of advertising in America. It's published by a non-academic press, Basic Books. but it assumes an audience with a substantive background in history, literature, economics, metaphysics, cultural theory, and art. Feeling inadequate? Me too. I had a tough time plowing through Fables of Abundance. But let me defensively add, I don't think it was all my fault. The book suffers from a bewildering embarrassment of riches. In addition to being a history of advertising, Fables of Abundance is also a philosophical exploration of how Americans relate to material things. Finally, its last lengthy section mutates, without much warning, into an aesthetic study of modern novelists and artists like Sinclair Lewis, Edward Steichen, and Joseph Cornell. In cautiously recommending Fables of Abundance, I feel a little like Lucy Ricardo hawking Vitamita Vegemin in perhaps the most famous TV commercial parody of all time. Like Vitamita Vegemin, Fables of Abundance is a miracle of compression. If you swallow it all down slowly, it'll give you pep. It's a tonic for the brain. And in the immortal words of Lucy, I can even say, semi-sincerely, it's tasty, too. The most invigorating thing about Fables of Abundance is its thesis, the base that holds this whole messy, generic concoction together. Like other scholars, historian Jackson Lears regards advertising as a force that's multiplied and manipulated Americans' desires. Especially in the 19th century, advertisements encouraged magical thinking about the transformative powers of objects. But Lears also makes a startling counterclaim. He says that with the development of a corporate economy at the turn of the 20th century, the emphasis of advertising changed. Lears writes, "Advertisements did more than stir up desire. They also sought to manage it, to stabilize the sorcery of the marketplace by containing dreams of personal transformation within a broader rhetoric of control." In other words, even as modern advertising awakened our hedonistic longings for material goods, it also repressed those longings and channeled them into a disciplined striving for new products. In Lear's nuanced interpretation, the history of advertising, especially in the 20th century, could be figured as something of a contest between the quintessential American huckster, P.T. Barnum, and the Puritan, John Winthrop, both of them grappling for the soul of the beleaguered consumer. Fables of Abundance is one of those sweeping works of epic scholarship that I regard with awe. After I've finished this kind of book, I always wonder, how does anyone ever manage to write something like this? But to be honest, the very next question that pops into my head is, and how many people nowadays are going to want to read something like this? But perhaps I'm underestimating the power of intellectuals and their ideas to influence American life. After all, a former professor of history named Newt Gingrich will certainly have the chance to present his own Fable of Abundance to the American people very shortly.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Fables of Abundance by Jackson Lears. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, and Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the man who brought us the music of Marvin Gaye, Smokey Robinson, The Temptations, The Supremes, and Little Stevie Wonder, we meet the founder of Motown Records, Berry Gordy. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
Ooh, every day there's something new. Honey, to keep me